This is Mark Steiner. Join me for the 12th Annual Annapolis Summit on January the 30th at the Calvert House in Annapolis. It's your turn to question the new governor-elect, Larry Hogan, and Senate President Mike Miller and House Speaker Mike Bush. Be part of the action determining the future of our state. Event details at thedailyrecord.com/Annapolis-summit. And for tickets, the number is 443-524-8101 or claire.sheehan@thedailyrecord.com. Join us for the Annapolis Summit, January the 30th. Welcome, everybody. This is Mark Steiner, and we are about to have our year-end wrap-up of what happened to us in this country and around the world over the last year and what popped up in the news, what were the most important things that faced us and our society. We are joined here by Bob Summerbee, who is editor of the Daily Howler, Lena McAllister, Republican strategist, former congressional candidate, host of Night Talk, Get to the Point on Pittsburgh Cable News Channel, and host of Get Right with Lenny McAllister. And you can also see his work at LennyMcAllister.com. And Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and executive director of Yes Magazine and YesMagazine.org. And welcome. Good to have all three of you with us.
Thanks, good to be here.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to all of you as well. Happy New Year and all the rest. So, it's, you know, when you look at this year, it seems to me one of the things, you always seem to focus on things that that happened more recently towards the end of the year, but and I might even begin that way, but it seems to me that one of the biggest stories in America and around the globe are the juxtapositions of things that seem to have happened in different places and how they came together. You know, you when you think about the issue of race in America became one of the kind of most prominent issues, I think, that happened in the media here from what happened with Trayvon Martin before this year, all the way through Eric Garner and Michael Brown, and how it brought together, as they said in the New Yorker, West Florissant Avenue of Ferguson and Bay Street in Staten Island, New York, that seemed to explode a movement and a coverage that we have not seen in this country for 40 years, I think, in many ways. Kind of bringing together the kind of the contradictions of race for the 21st century around systemic racism, around police brutality, around the condition of so many people in the African-American communities. Sarah Gelder, Van Gelder, let me start with you. I think, to me, that is one of the most significant things in the news from this last year that I can think of in this country.
Yeah, Mark, I totally agree with you. And it's interesting because, you know, the question of police treatment of African-Americans, that has not changed that much this year in terms of how many people have been brutalized, how many people have been killed. But what has changed is the degree to which there is now a pushback on that. And a lot of that came right out of Ferguson from those young people who wouldn't let it alone, who just went out on the street night after night after night saying this is not okay, doing all sorts of protesting, most of which, vast majority of which, was nonviolent. The police making fools of themselves by, you know, by using tear gas and rubber bullets unnecessarily, and those young people just wouldn't give it up. And I just think that they just deserve huge recognition and huge respect for, you know, for what they launched, because they empowered and inspired people all over the country to do likewise.
And I think it also revealed this year that the underbelly of racism and race in America as a defining factor for our nation and culture has also come bubbling to the surface, as it has for years now. But I think it really came to a head this year and is forcing people to wrestle with this in ways they have not for a long time. Many people think, oh, everything's okay. There's an African-American president. Everything's okay. Life is different. This is not 1960. But it is, I think, in some ways more glaring now because of those contradictions than ever before. And this has caused, I think, in some ways, this is part of the gigantic rift in America that has taken place politically and over race as well. Jump in, Bob.
Yeah.
Okay, Sarah. Then we can go to Bob.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that. And, you know, the Politico just put out a study that shows that black youth black men are 21 times more likely to be killed by police than are white youth. So these are just stunningly important questions, and I think they're causing people, whether or not they're involved in the criminal justice system, whether they're in the school system, where young people of color are far more likely to be treated much more harshly in terms of any punishments they get for infractions, whether it's in stores where young people of color are likely to be followed around, you know, if they're just trying to shop, whether it's in places like New Orleans where Hurricane Katrina, the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina was almost like a second entire disaster because of how much the victims of the hurricane were treated as though they were criminals. You know, in one place after another in our society, we see how racism has just devastated our communities, and I think people across the board, white and black, are really thinking about that in new ways.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see the way race has become a topic of discussion this year. And as Sarah said, I'm not sure, I'm not entirely sure how to explain that, but it's not clear that any conduct has changed. It's more that reaction has changed, and I guess social media has changed. It raises a question, and I'm not sure where these discussions and protests and demonstrations are going to lead. The young people in Ferguson who started a lot of this, it's a little bit takes us back to Occupy Wall Street, which kind of came and went and never quite solidified into an ongoing protest movement. There's a lot of talk out of Ferguson's, this isn't your grandmother's or grandfather's civil rights movement. And that may be good and that may be bad. You know, the 1950s and 1960s civil rights movement had leadership that was morally and intellectually brilliant. Morally and intellectually brilliant. And they did have leadership, Dr. King and many others. That leadership style isn't forming at this point in this in this new discussion, and I'm not sure that I see these. I'm just wondering where these discussions are going to take us. It's hard to say.
Well, let me throw this in here, and let me jump into this.
Well, let me say one other thing, Mark. This is something I've complained about, and I'm annoyed by. It almost seems. And I speak as someone who's talked about education for black kids, and I started out in the Baltimore City schools long ago. It almost seems you can't get anyone to talk about the interests of black kids unless someone gets shot and killed. And I find that really offensive. You can't get people, including liberals and progressives, to talk about what goes on in schools, what kids' experiences are like in schools, what their experiences are like growing up. You can't get people to talk about that over the years. You can't. And it really, there's almost something wrong when we can only get upset when someone is killed.
But I think the difference is.
Not that that's not a significant event, obviously. That's a rather significant event.
What I'm going to say is I think that the significance of that in this case is, Lenny McAllister, is that this has a story that is about the frequency of both abuse and targeting and murders of young black people and people of color in this country one every 28 hours. That is why it's significant and why this movement in some ways, I think because of how it affects America so deeply personally and so many people are touching base with it, black and white and Asian and Latino in this country, it does have legs. Whether you agree politically with it being on the progressive side or left side mostly, it is a movement I think has legs, why it will continue further on than Occupy ever did.
Well, I think there are a couple things that we have to take into consideration. Number one, there are conservatives like me that understand that we're talking about national sovereignty. If you continue to limit the potential of your talent base, of your human capital, if you continue to ignore people in urban America and not see them as being contributors to the American society, there's no way for you to win when it comes to a global landscape, whether it's geopolitical or geoeconomic. And so you have little tiny rogue countries like North Korea that can take down a large American corporation and
right.
Industries such as you just had here a couple of days ago. So when you look at that, there's an understanding that from a conservative side that this is something we all need to look at. If you're going to be a constitutional conservative, all American citizens are afforded rights, not just ones of a lighter hue of skin. That's something that, number one, we have to take into consideration. But I think number two and more important is the fact that there's a understanding that what we're experiencing with folks in urban America, folks that we're seeing with college students, folks that we're seeing rallying with the millennials, is the fact that these things have been talked about now for years. This isn't something that just transpired in 2014. We were just rallying about Trayvon Martin in 2012 and 2013. But people are realizing that it's that their voice can be heard, that through social media, through some of the new school tactics that younger folks, both in Generation X and the millennial generation, are employing, you can get attention in mainstream media. You can create worldwide movements with opening your voice, or in some instances, click-clacking on your phone or getting on your laptop. And I think that makes a difference. Now, it goes back to the point that was raised previously. Where do we go from here? I don't think that we need a couple of central figures to point where we need to go, but we do need a sense of direction in regards to what should the laws look like, what should the economy look like, what must the schools look like, and what must society do moving forward. And that takes more than just hashtag activism. That takes a sense of true combining of forces, a true sense of diverse and long-lasting leadership. And it takes a level of persistence that I'm hoping that we'll see. Not a lot of people are talking about Trayvon Martin anymore. I'm hoping that people will talk about Leon Ford Jr. and Jordan Miles and Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown and Tamir Rice and all of these folks 2015, 2016, and beyond, so that we're not listing off a brand new list in 2015, 16, 17, and 18.
What the three of you said made me kind of think of where we might be going, and this is kind of switching gears and looking back, but it really hit me, and I'd just like to kind of ask you all this. I'm thinking about how, you know, in the recent news, we've seen President Barack Obama renewing diplomatic relations with Cuba. That is a huge step and a huge diplomatic move in this country. We've seen President Barack Obama take on the question of immigration and with his presidential prerogatives. And you've seen him making statements around the police and more in this country. And then you, with the election of, which is another big event that happened this year, the election of a Republican-controlled Senate and more power in Congress and many more governors. I wonder what you think, Sarah, and even though there's a lot of shortcomings we can talk about, that this might portend for the Obama presidency. Someone said to me the other night as we were talking about this, they think that what we're going to see because of the Republican power in Congress now, as they put it, a more muscular presidency on the part of Obama in his last days to take on things he believes in. How do you think this is going to run out?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, he's got two more years left, and he's got a legacy to build at this point because so many of his other initiatives have been blocked by the hostility from Congress. So I think he doesn't have a lot to lose by actually doing some things that show some backbone. And the immigration and the Cuba example are a couple of those. I think one of the things that this shows, especially the action on immigration, is the way in which people's movements and pressure from the bottom up really seems to work. I think there are places where Obama might just as soon not have acted, but I think the way in which ordinary people have just been relentless on some of these topics, I think that's made a difference. And I think it made a difference also in terms of Governor Cuomo deciding to ban fracking. You know, that was a major effort on the part of activists throughout New York State, but especially in the Finger Lakes region, who've been concerned about the environmental impacts and the health impacts of fracking for natural gas. And Governor Cuomo was finally convinced both by this relentless activism and also by the scientific research that shows that it really does have significant health questions related to that practice. So I think this all points back to how important it is for ordinary people to be involved. And sometimes it doesn't feel like that's making a difference. But I think when you look at the long term, you can see that it really does.
There's no question the agenda seems to bubble up from below now in a way that just wasn't the case in the past. It used to be said that the New York Times set the agenda, and it did. And now it's sort of like Twitter sets the agenda, which is a very different process. And it's to me, it's a strange change in American life, but it definitely seems to be unfolding in front of our very eyes. It's a very strange change.
It shouldn't be strange. Just the fact that you're saying that is strange. We have a representative form of government. So you now finally have people over the course of the last several years, people that were outraged about the Iraq War, starting in 2003, 2004-ish, around that presidential election, moving into the midterms of 2006, people getting engaged with the election of Barack Obama, which came out of nowhere, midterm with the Tea Party, moving on through for the last couple of years, the re-election of President Obama, moving on to 2014, and these midterms, you finally have more people that feel engaged in the system. Now, let's keep them engaged and raise the consciousness and the type of conversations that more Americans are having so that this representative form of government can get back to being more efficient and working so that the 114th Congress isn't as woeful as the 113th Congress has been.
Well, good luck with that. I don't mean there's anything wrong with the process when I say it's strange. I mean it's a very large change in the way the agenda flows in the country, and it's developing mysteriously. No one is directing it. It's not like some directive came down from somewhere. It's an organic change.
The people are directing it. The people are directing it.
I understand.
It's absolutely being driven.
I understand. It's not being done in the old way, and that's what makes it the new way. It's coming from undefined locations. Which didn't exist before.
This is the traditional way. This is the constitutional way. Just the fact that we're using this type of language shows how far gone we are.
I'm not arguing with you. I'm saying it's different. Okay. It's different.
So, I think it also shows in part that the failure of the two parties, both Democratic and Republican parties, who have failed to provide the kind of leadership that so many people are yearning for. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons that so much of this is now happening from the grassroots up is precisely because those two parties have become so much in the pocket of Wall Street and the big corporations, and the agenda that ordinary people have, that agenda is not being reflected inside the Beltway. So both on the left and the right, and in some cases in really interesting new combinations of the two, we're seeing a different kind of agenda coming from the bottom up.
It's certainly true. There's been no agenda from the Democratic Party. I mean, the Democratic Party was basically AWOL this past year, and you sort of saw that in the results of the elections, which were somewhat predictable. But, boy, what was the agenda that, well, if you could say that an agenda was rejected, what was the agenda that was rejected? There wasn't really an agenda. So, you know, that's just, to me, a terrible problem that's developing right now. When you see Elizabeth Warren, when you hear her speak, it's so shocking to hear someone say things like she says. Someone in the Democratic Party say anything that's definable and accurate. It's kind of a shock. You just don't hear politicians say things that are accurate, and she sort of does it all the time. It's an anomaly, and there's just something terribly wrong. Obviously, our political parties have just collapsed in on themselves.
So, and I think, and to picking up on that point, to push that a little further, I think that's you're seeing that on right and left in America. I mean, it began on the right with the Tea Party and the explosion from the right, which, even though it was fueled a lot by kind of Koch brother money, it also touched a nerve with a lot of grassroots, very conservative and libertarian white people around the country that exploded into the Tea Party. You're seeing it now around Ferguson. You've seen it around other local issues around the country where people are exploding, kind of what people call appeal on the progressive and the left side. And I think that's one of the kind of stories the mainstream media is not talking about, which is this kind of this huge disenchantment that people have. And I think one of those things that shows that is the low turnout in these elections on both Republican and Democrat, on traditional Republican and Democratic voters, what would be traditional Republican and Democratic voters opting out of the entire system, to me is one of the stories of this country, the lowest turnout in 72 years that took place in this country in this last election. I mean, that to me is a significant sub-story that they don't want to tackle because it because of who controls our media and what that media tells us.
What our media tells us is, what did Hillary Clinton say yesterday? And I'm not even saying that to be critical of Hillary Clinton, but it's just the most tiresome, tedious. It's in the New York Times, you know, as we speak today. It's just tiresome and tedious. The mainstream media really discusses nothing.
I wouldn't disagree with that. And I don't think sure would. Lenny?
You know, the mainstream media... They're an entity. They're an entity that follows what we want them to talk about. And so it's not, it's a lot more symbiotic than we make it out to be. You know, a lot of times we say that we want more from the mainstream media, but then as soon as the mainstream media gives us more, we don't tune in, we don't give our advertising dollars, and it goes away. So, I mean, the one good thing about what we have in America is the fact that you can have a symbiotic relationship. You can dictate what's going on. I mean, think about it. At one point in time, the Tea Party was trying to be ignored. At one point in time, Trayvon Martin was supposed, that whole situation was supposed to be swept underneath the rug. And next thing you know, it became mainstream news across the world because the American people have driven it. Now, you have things such as social media. You have people that feel more engaged with their government. There are good and bad things to having a few more Mr. Smiths going to Washington. To be quite honest, we need even more Mr. Smiths going to Washington. We still have a big problem when it comes to big money involved in politics because, let's be real, you can't get involved in politics by and large in today's America unless if you're independently wealthy. And that needs a change. When you have that, you have a sense of an oligarchy that remains entrenched, that has populism touching it every now and then, but by and large, you still have this sense of us versus them. And America never is going to work if you have an us versus them mentality, because one way or another, we're going to shift away from that representative form of government. It's going to stop being a republic that's based off of democracy, and it's going to be more along the lines of haves and have-nots and policies that are going to be driven therein. So 2015 has to show more effort going from the protests that we've seen from Ferguson to New York to some of the upheavals that we've seen in regards to the economic disparities, moving over to seeing policies come into place or politicians coming into place that represent more of the 99. And so, let's just be honest, 2014 didn't even do that, even with the midterms.
Sarah, let me come back to something that Lenny said in the beginning, because I think as a publisher and co-founder of the presses outside the establishment, you may have a little different view about the symbiotic relationship that America has with its press.
Yeah, I certainly do. I would agree with a lot of what was just said about the influence of money in politics, but I'd also say that a lot of that influence is also very strong within the mainstream media. We know that large corporations own most of the media, and they have their own agenda. And between that and the advertising that those media want to attract, that is certainly influential. So, you know, if we look at some of the topics that don't get covered, one of them would be net neutrality. Why isn't it covered? Well, the same corporations that own most of our media also would like to have more influence over the way the Internet operates. And so there was over 3 million, I believe it was 3.7 million comments to the FCC over the rules that would allow the Internet to stay open and free. And yet you hardly see a mention of that in the mainstream media. So that, again, was one of those bottom-up efforts that ordinary people undertook in spite of being ignored by the mainstream media. Another one that's really critical is the whole question of climate change. The New York Times has cut way back on their environmental coverage. They actually got rid of their environmental department, and I believe they've rehired some of their
They did rehire them, yeah, right.
But then on NPR, they've also been getting rid of a lot of their environmental reporters. So we have one of the biggest questions about the continuation of human civilization, which is what's happening with the disruption of the climate and what that means for not only our children's generation, but really our own generation. And the mainstream media is largely absent. And one of the big stories I think that deserves to be told for this year is the extent of that climate march in New York in the fall, and how many people now across all the generations and across the races and across classes, how many people are now coming to terms with just how critical that climate issue is and how much that's going to define what we choose to do in terms of our economy, in terms of our sources of energy, in terms of how we live, how much we need to be rethinking what it means to live in a way that is compatible with the natural systems of the planet that we rely on for survival.
I think you raise a really important point here, Bob. I'll let you jump right in. And one of the things I think that we're talking about here, when you look at these how they've the major newspapers and NPR, what NPR did in really they shut down their climate change desk. They shut it down. And that dispersed their reporters off to do other things and doing other stories around the environment and climate change when they think it's necessary. They say that's going to enhance their coverage. That would be their argument. But the other part looks at, you know, then you have to listen to, on National Public Radio, who their main underwriters are. And it's gas and how lovely the gas industry is and what we bring you for the future of America and all the other kind of underwriting you see and how that affects what happens on the news, whether it's public media or whether it's commercial media. I think that those are real factors in what people get to see and don't see.
Well, I must say this has been a year when I've seen the topics that produce a lot of coverage are the kind of big flash – approachable topics, domestic violence, the rape culture on campus, police misconduct. These are relatively easy topics to talk about. Climate change, why we pay so much for health care, these are much more difficult topics. And we seemed in the course of this past year to be speeding through a series of high-profile topics where for one month at a time we treat a topic like it's the most important thing in the world, and then it goes away and it's never heard from again. Have you heard the name Bo Bergdahl lately? Or, you know, what have you heard about the missing airplane? We seem to be cycling through a lot of high-flash topics, but the topics you mentioned, climate change, a topic that fascinates me, the cost of health care, which the New York Times is doing gigantic front-page reports about while completely dodging the basic. They focus on one procedure after another, how weird the pricing is for this particular procedure, and they almost never get back to the gigantic amounts we spend for health care as opposed to every other country in the world. And where is all that money going? Their avoidance of that topic, which is the dangerous question, is just it just jumps out at me. Whatever's bubbling up on social media, it's hard to create discussions across which can jump from the left over to the right, from Occupy Wall Street over to the Tea Party. And that's what we have to find ways to do to reach across these gigantic divides which have been produced by propagandistic news from different directions and force discussions about serious, real issues, the basic issues that affect everything in human life.
We have to take a very brief break here, and kind of a little pushback on what Bob said when we come back from this break and talk a bit about what that divide is America has been represented in our news and the events of the nation. But then I want to ask all of our three guests here what they think are the kind of hidden topics we're not talking about that came through this year that we need to focus on and think about what they mean in depth. Bob Somerville is editor of the Daily Howler. Sarah Van Gelder is co-founder and executive director of Yes Magazine and yesmagazine.org. Lynn McAllister, Republican strategist and media host. And we'll be right back after this break. And on our way to break, we're hearing Masters of War, written by Bob Dylan, performed by Odetta, who was born on this day in 1930.
You that hide behind walls.
Load up on guns, bring your friends, it's fun to...
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Patti Smith. Smells Like Teen Spirit, born on this day in 1946. Good year, 1946. Bob Somerville is with us, editor of the Daily Howler. Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and executive director of Yes Magazine and yesmagazine.org. Lennon McAllister, Republican strategist, current host of Night Talk and Get Right with Lennon McAllister. And his work is on LennonMcAllister.com. So, you know, I have a lot of criticism of the media in this country. Think about what Bob was just saying in the end. But before we went to break, but I want to posit this, and let me jump to Sarah and then Lenny and around this, is that I think that the media has fallen apart. They are not doing the job I think they should be doing. The media has changed drastically, obviously, in the last 40 years and how it's defined. But the divide we're seeing, while I think is fueled and pushed by the media in some ways, didn't originate with the media. The divide in this country is deep because of the divide in ideology built around race and class and other issues in America that has caused a divide that I think is being exacerbated, pushed, and wedged even deeper by the media. How do you see it, Sarah?
Well, first off, I want to really question the kind of divide that the media keeps coming back to. They love stories that have two clear sides, and they love to oversimplify. And if it's the Democrats versus the Republicans or the Tea Party versus the mainstream Republican, you know, they just love that sort of simplified narrative. But I think the actual narrative is far more complicated and actually far more interesting. One that I think is really important to look at is the whole question of which part of both political parties are in the pocket of the big corporations and doing whatever Wall Street wants. So they just included in the recent budget bill a major deregulation of a bill, the Dodd-Frank bill, that came about after the 2008 collapse that was intended to protect ordinary people from the kind of shenanigans that we saw, you know, that led to the economic collapse. And, you know, they've undone that in part because both parties have so much, you know, that they owe to and are willing to be controlled by in terms of what's going on in Wall Street. And on a grassroots basis, you see people across the political spectrum who would like to see us no longer subsidizing too-big-to-fail banks and no longer protecting them with taxpayer money. So if you ask people that on the left and the right, you're going to get very similar answers, even though, again, the parties tend to stay with that narrative. So that's one thing. A second thing I think that we're not talking about enough, although it has been on the agenda a bunch this year, is the question that Occupy brought up, the question of massive inequality in our society and how that's continuing to erode the prospects for the middle class, whether that's getting a college education or being able to find affordable housing or knowing that you can rely on health care, although Obamacare is helping to address that. But the enormity of that inequality, it distorts everything else that we do. It creates displacement in our cities. It creates a really lopsided access to the political process of who can, you know, buy a seat in Congress or get heard in Congress and who can't. So inequality is a huge issue, and the fact that the city of Seattle passed a $15 minimum wage this year is just one of the places where I think on the grassroots basis you're seeing a pushback on inequality. And then the third thing I would say that we're not hearing enough about is the way in which people at the grassroots are pushing back against this extreme energy development that is not only terrifically hazardous from a climate perspective, but is also really detrimental to people in local communities all over the country. So we see that in the pushback against fracking out here in the Pacific Northwest. We see an enormous story, actually, that's just barely been reported, of a collaboration between the native tribes and the environmental activists and community activists to try to keep the big tar sands pipelines from going through, to try to keep coal trains from going through, and brand new export infrastructure to allow huge amounts of fossil fuel in the form of coal and natural gas and tar sands oil to be exported to Asia. So again, those are all have huge climate implications because making that energy cheap for export encourages it to be used as opposed to being, you know, the transition to renewables that we so badly need. But it's also got all these local implications because people are saying, you know, I don't want those poisonous substances in my backyard. So those are several of the things I think are really exciting that are going on this year.
Yeah, I think the portent was about what's going to happen in the next year, and I want to come back to some of the topics you just raised here. Lenny, you want to jump in here?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that we have to look at. Again, one of the things that continues to go on is the fact that we see and continue to hear, and President Obama's been quote-unquote bragging about this for the last couple of months, that America's on a comeback and it's on a resurgence, but there's not a lot of people that see that resurgence. There's not a lot of Americans that are living that resurgence. You know, we just had a report that came out that said 40% of America is poorer now than they were before the Great Recession. You know, the banks aren't going to say that, and the upper 1% aren't saying that. There's record gains on Wall Street. But 40% of our nation is poorer now than they were when the Great Recession started, which people, you know, people hear that. They have to understand that technically when people say these things, the Great Recession ended in 2009 and started in 2007. So we're 10 years almost from the start of the Great Recession when this all transpired. So we're no longer talking about a year-long hiccup. We're almost to a point of time where you have a generation of kids that may have been born in 2007, 2008 that know nothing other than these economic conditions. You have a generation of millennials that were in school, early in school when this started, and now they're coming out of college, which know nothing other than get 2 degrees, get a job for $9 an hour. That has to shift and change. Now, what do we do with this Congress coming in 2015? How do they govern? How do they govern from a federal perspective that allows that innovation to come back, to allow good-paying jobs to come back? They're no longer going to be able to complain about this president. Good leadership, good Republican leadership is going to be able to get this president to come more to the center, let him understand that there are things you can compromise with us on, just as we did in December 2010 in a lame duck session with the Democrats, to get things done for this nation, get the unemployment rate down in the right way, not just getting it down because people aren't coming back or people are willing to take $8 an hour jobs. Get it down in the right way and truly get all of America back on track. Let's solidify the potholes that we're continuously hitting on Main Street so that both Main Street and Wall Street have a smooth sailing path to prosperity. That's what we need to see moving forward from the Republicans that are taking over Congress in January.
Well, I can't say I'm expecting that, but these things can happen. As I listen to Eleni and Sarah, I mean, here's the thing that I constantly wonder about. How do we create discussions about these complex issues? The complex issues. No one understands. No one in this country understands big banks. No one understands when we start talking about derivatives. No one knows what derivatives are. No one. This is not like talking about police misconduct where everyone basically can picture what's being discussed. How do we create conversations about these complex, obscure topics, A, that people will listen to, and B, where people on the so-called left and the so-called right can start to come to see that they may have mutual interests? Everyone is being looted in healthcare spending, for example. You would assume that the remarkable cost of higher education affects people on various sides of various dividing lines. How do we create conversations that people, A, will listen to, B, will understand, and C, will see their mutual interests in across? Because there are propaganda organizations that are pounding propaganda at people who think they're conservatives and people who think they're liberals. And people are hearing very different stories about the world all the time. And they're being told, don't listen to those other people. And these forces have become more powerful in recent years. They're in the last few decades, there's more of smaller entities springing up, smaller news organizations. How do we create discussions that break through the division that's being pushed out by this propagandization? How do we do it? I don't know. I don't see a lot of skill, a high skill level in that right now.
Well, I mean, this is interesting.
There's not a need for that skill level. Unfortunately, the people that are coming out in voting, the people that are coming out and driving politics, and people that are, generally speaking, keeping the conversation going, are not requiring an elevation of that skill set with more Americans. So that skill set to make that high-level perspective or high skill level of understanding as to where we are, to where we need to go, starts being filtered down. And remember, we weren't talking about the debt ceiling. We weren't talking about American debt or anything else just 15 years ago. The only people that were talking about that were the people that followed Ron Paul, and even the Republicans didn't like those individuals. By 2011, everybody wanted to talk about the national debt ceiling, spending, and everything else along those lines, so it can be done. But again, it goes back to who's going to be charismatic enough to rally the troops, who's going to be communicative enough to be able to get the point across in bite-sized portions, and who's going to be persistent enough to stay the course when it goes from boring to top of the headlines or top of the news story, because that's a process. It can happen. We'll see it, and it's going to be interesting because 2015 is going to bring us our presidential candidates as well. The good presidential candidates will be the folks that are able to do the things I just mentioned as well.
I think this is actually a time when that kind of top-down discussion isn't going to take us where we need to go. I think it's a lot of what's going to be the most fruitful is going to be actually bottom-up, where people at the grassroots realize that, you know, that the discussion, as has been dominated by the two political parties, has been taking us in the wrong direction. I mean, the whole thing about the debt ceiling, you know, was a question the Republicans really weren't interested in as long as W. Bush was in charge and was bringing up our national debt to tremendous heights, and they only got interested in it when a Democrat got involved. At the grassroots, I think there's a question of, you know, people having a much more pragmatic and much more down-to-earth question. We just did, at Yes Magazine, we just did an issue on cities.
Right.
And one of the things we found was that, you know, at the city level, people just don't care that much if you're a Republican or Democrat. The question is, can you get the garbage picked up? Can you help the economy flourish? Can you make sure that kids have good schools to go to and that there's a way to provide a safety net for the people who are at the bottom? And those questions become far more pragmatic and far more about human beings and about our collective way of living, and far less ideological and far less also determined by who has the money. So I think that's the place to go, is to not allow those big charismatic leaders to sway things too much, but to really ask ourselves those questions and insist on talking to people, not only the people that we already agree with, but the people who look different than us, who have different backgrounds than us, and who may have different ideological basis, but have really the same interests when you get right down to it.
You know, the thing, I so much agree with that. The thing I feel more than anything else at the end of this year, I feel I'm tired of being told I'm supposed to hate everyone on the other team. You know, and that's what we're told this on Fox. We're sort of told this now on MSNBC. To be honest, there's a lot of that going on. We're told it at sites like Salon, which is developing as a very, I consider it pseudo-progressive site. I'm so tired of being told as a liberal or progressive or Democrat that I'm supposed to hate everyone over there. I'm sick of that. Yeah, I can't see how that does anything but lead to a dead end, given the way our government works. It just produces a dead end. And I don't think it's true. And it's the easiest message to churn out to make money in corporate media, including corporate progressive media. I'm so sick of it. And I don't see where it takes us. And I want to see the person who comes out and finds a way to make it. That's what Obama was talking about in 2004. It sort of didn't happen. You know, there's no red. We have Little League and in blue America, and they have gay people in red America. I don't remember what he said. people went crazy over that. But it didn't happen with him. It didn't happen with him. But how do we I don't see how we get anywhere if we don't find a way to break down this training that we're supposed to hate the other tribe.
Maybe.
I mean, it's very maybe easy. I mean, I'm sorry, go ahead, Mark.
I was going to say that maybe one of the big stories for this year, it's interesting where this conversation went, and I think that the idea that the grassroots of what's happening beyond the headlines of what the policymakers in Congress and the rest are doing, what's bubbling up at the bottom is where I think the change will come. And I think that you're seeing this. I'm going to say a little anecdote about how these stories can cross and how people can cross. Let's take what you were talking about earlier in the program, which was about the XL pipeline and people opposing all through the Midwest this pipeline. And there was this meeting that took place. I think if I have this right, it was in Nebraska, and they were arguing over the pipeline. And these farmers and ranchers were saying how this pipeline. These are guys who for the most part vote Republican or very conservative politically. Started saying, you know, that the pipeline is going to destroy our land. We got to stop these people from putting this pipeline through here. We don't need it. All this oil is not for us. This is going to destroy who we are. Could kill our aquifer, kill our agriculture. And he looked up and said, they're treating us like a bunch of – and he stopped mid-sentence because the other half of the people in the room were Indians, were Native people. And they looked at him, and he looked at them. And they said – he said, Indians? Oh. Now you understand. Oh. So but to me, that story is emblematic of what causes change in America from the bottom up that makes people kind of wrestle with their own race and racism in America. But more importantly, as importantly, it makes people kind of begin to see their common ground.
Right.
In terms of what's facing this country and how you have to – that's why it's bubbling up from the bottom, because historically, the only time change really happens in America, civil rights and more, is when the federal government would intervene. But the federal government is frozen because of corporate power and other kinds of things at the moment. They're not intervening in anything. So that's why I think that the grassroots is where we're seeing this kind of explosion that may be one of the hidden stories of this year.
If there's such a thing as the 99% and the 1%, we can't allow ourselves in the 99% to be told, well, you have to hate half of the 99% because they're blue and you're red, or because they're red and you're blue. And that is what we're being told. And it allows the 1%, I'm just using rough figures here, it allows the 1% to divide and conquer. It's just,
but that's literally abdicating a lot of the responsibility that a vast majority of Americans have. Let's just be honest. You know, most Democrats could not name five Republicans that they would vote for. And there are probably, you know, three Democrats that maybe Republicans would vote for, because even though you could say that the mainstream media and others tell you to hate them, as soon as there's an issue that a Democrat disagrees with a Republican on, it goes to, see, that's what I mean. Not, well, this is what we need to disagree on and compromise on. And I've seen this as a candidate, I've seen this as an activist, and I've seen this in the media. This is something that we just don't want to do yet in America. I mean, that's one of the things that I was told that kind of made me both unique as a candidate, but also put me at a disadvantage, is the fact that there were Democrats that liked me, but it goes against the rule. And it's not just because of what people are told to do. It's because we just have this ideology that everybody's supposed to agree with us 100%
absolutely
of the time.
Absolutely.
That's become more of our mantra, less about what we're told from the mainstream media. That's something that we've taken in as an American people, that even if that message comes to us, we still have the ability to push back on it. Again, we're also told that, hey, you know, the police are lawful individuals enforcing authority, but we've seen the pushback on that as well. We've seen the die-ins and everything else, so we know that Americans still have the capability to push back on this narrative. It's just a matter of, are we willing to do it when it comes to politics and break the mold once again?
So, Sarah Van Gelder, but part of the story, I think, in this is that it's beyond Republicans and Democrats.
Well, exactly. And I think that helps, especially at the local level, where people can actually encounter one another face-to-face and get to know each other as human beings and find out that people are actually far more complex than those sort of caricatures that show up in the media. But part of the problem there is that we've actually become such a segregated society, in that we tend to live with the people we already know and people who look like us and people who have the same class. So it's actually, I think, has contributed to that sense of polarization. And one of the things that I think is really important to do on the local level is just to consciously choose to reach out to people who are different than yourself, to cross those lines, whether it's a white church and a black church choosing to have potlucks together now and then, or whether it's, you know, choosing to live in a neighborhood where you don't look like everybody else, or, you know, whatever it is. I think
right. It's
part of us getting to a saner kind of politics is just getting to know each other better.
And I think this kind of struggle about redefining who we are is also one of these kind of hidden pieces that are coming through. Because I think there are a lot of very frustrated people in our country at this moment, you know. And I think that when people look at one of the big stories of the year, the torture memos when they came out, I think people are it's interesting how that particular story resonated weekly. W-E-A-K, not W-E-E-K, weekly, with the American people. It didn't grab them. It took a back seat to the stories around race. It took a back seat to other stories that were affecting people's lives daily. It didn't affect them in the same way, I think, for some of these reasons.
Well, people were not opposed to enhanced interrogation techniques in the polling. And that's an interesting fact. I don't know that it's a shocking fact. We've been riding a wave of self-congratulation since Adolf Hitler came to power, that we're the good guys and it was everyone else that was the bad guys doing the bad things. And I'm not totally shocked that when push came to shove, people in this country were willing to, you know, these polls came out within the last few weeks of the year, the end of the year, of what people thought about enhanced interrogation techniques. And majorities were not troubled by them. I don't find that shocking, but, you know, we've been riding a wave of Hollywood movies for 70 years in which that's what the other teams did, and we never did that, and we were always the good guys. Well, it wasn't quite that simple.
No, you can't. Well, it's a little bit more complex than that, even though it does go to one thing. When you release this in December, after we've watched for the past several months, Westerners and Americans get their heads cut off by ISIS, we sit there and say, well, if they're cutting off heads basically with butter knives, and how are we going to stop that before somebody blows up more buildings in America? We almost had Times Square almost blown up in 2010, and now we have people that are civilians getting their heads cut off by ISIS. No, we knew what we were doing 13 years ago. We understand that it was wrong, but in the grand scheme of things, we said we were going to move away from that, and we're dealing with people that are a lot worse than we are, so let's stop our practice, but we're not going to lose focus on what's going on out there. So, I mean, I think that's part of the reason why it resonated so weakly, W-E-A-K-L-Y, as it did over the last couple of weeks when this torture report came out.
Yeah,
Sarah, let me let you jump in on this.
Yeah, I do think that people are coming to terms with American exceptionalism and whether or not we can claim to be the universal good guy and the universal police. And again, I think there's people on the libertarian side of the spectrum who don't want us to be international police, just as there are people on the progressive side of that. But there's one other piece of this story that I think is really interesting to look at, which is that the CIA tried really hard to keep this information from being released.
Right.
And it was released in the end. And so if there's one thing that gives me hope about this story, it's the fact that our democratic institution, our U.S. Senate, the chutzpah of Dianne Feinstein to not allow the CIA to bully her, this did come out. And we have to remember that's what distinguishes a powerful country from a powerful country that's a democracy from a tyranny, is that the democratic institutions hold and there's transparency and the truth comes out. And how people deal with that in the moment is important, but it's not the only part of that story.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. And Bobby, you want to say something?
That's a good point. I was going to say the problem from one perspective is when it came out, it was sort of 55 to 35 people sort of not being troubled particularly by what came out. And again, with respect to what Lenny said, as I said, I don't find that shocking. If you think there are crazy people trying to destroy your world, I don't personally find it shocking that people might tilt toward doing unpleasant things. I would say, again, with respect to the earlier conversation we had, that makes me – I would say to people on the left, don't hate the 55%. It's not completely crazy that people think that way. Try to persuade them if you think they're wrong. Persuade them. Don't hate them.
So I wish we were just about out of time here. What we didn't talk about at all was the opening of this door of Cuba, which in these 2.5 minutes we have left, which I think is going to be have reverberations in a very interesting way in the coming year. I think you're going to see this being one of the most politically important international decisions, I think, that have been made in a long time. A quick closing thoughts. We'll go around the room. Very quick closing thoughts. Bob, Lenny, and close out with Sarah.
I have no thoughts on the opening to Cuba, although I have a Cuban. My niece is married to a Cuban.
That's right.
And we have Cuban relatives in Cuba. In-laws. So it's good that people are going to be able to go to Cuba. For me, I want emerging liberal sites to reach out and stop teaching other liberals that we live in a two-tribe world and we're supposed to hate and fear the other tribe. I think that's just bad progressive politics.
Lenny, very quickly.
I think that I want to echo that and say that, look, it's truly about one big team. And we need to see America as that team once again. And if we do that in 2015, we'll have a glorious 21st century.
Sarah Van Gelder.
Yeah, I just want to say that I think populism is making a comeback, that ordinary people are taking a common sense look at things like what kind of economy we want and how to root it in our communities instead of allow it to be controlled by the 1%. And I think that to the degree that we can do that in a really common sense, open, compassionate way with one another, we have some real possibilities moving forward.
Sarah Van Gelder is co-founder and executive editor of Yes Magazine and yesmagazine.org. Len McAllister is Republican strategist and current host of Mike Talk, Get to the Point, and Get Right with Len McAllister. And you can see his work at lennymcallister.com. And Bob Summerby is editor of the Daily Howler. Thank you so much, and Happy New Year to you all.
Same to you.
Happy New Year. God bless.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it.
On our way to break, we're hearing I Feel Love by Donna Summer, born on this day in 1948.